Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to film sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosie.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosie.
Film lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosey. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. In a little bit, I'll be chatting with fellow film critic Sam Watermeyer, but first, film sociology correspondent McKenna May turns the show into stage sociology, which I've been known to do from time to time. So here's McKenna May's talking with Georgiana Wade of the Young Actors Theater Company. Enjoy.
So what is Young Actors Theater?
At Young Actors Theater, our mission is to instill confidence, creativity, and discipline through the art of theater and create theatrical opportunities for our students that teach self-empowerment. It was founded in 1976, actually, by a retired actress out of New York named Charlotte Kaufman. And our executive director, Justin Wade, he was her student. So he took over the program in 2005. And when he took it over, we started doing something that we call self-empowerment theater, which is a method of working with our students and developing shows that we've developed over the years that really, really focuses on the growth of the student and the growth of the student through the process, not just the end performance. At YAT, we do a lot of devised theater, which means that we don't start with a script. So the students, the actors, the student designers, everybody kind of has a say in where the story's going, what happens, what makes it into the piece. And we've found that that's been a really fun and effective way to work with our students educationally, but also creatively, just to, you know, teach them the importance of storytelling and the importance of going through the hero's journey and, you know, putting obstacles in the face of the protagonist that they overcome. We think that that helps give kids tools for life, that when they walk out of our program, that no matter what comes our way, you know, they will know that they too, just like Oliver Twist, just like Red Riding Hood, that they can overcome obstacles that come their way.
And where did this decision to kind of focus on young people come from?
So that was originally the whole idea behind what Charlotte Kaufman wanted to do back in the 1970s when she moved to Indianapolis. She wanted to work with kids. She wanted to teach them. She had been working at other youth theaters in the nation and hadn't been pleased with what training was available for young students. She trained at the Goodman Theater and she trained in Stanislavski and. You know, she had a lot of acting training that she wanted to do, and she wanted to give kids a more formalized training experience. And so that's what her whole mission was. And then when we took over, or when Justin took over Young Actors Theater, and then I joined in 2010, you know, what we're excited about with working with young people is the endless scope of their imagination. And, you know, I mean, you tell a room of kindergarten through third graders to be an evil forest, and that's going to be the most evil forest you've ever seen. You know, I mean, they're uninhibited. They're excited. They can buy into role playing and using their imagination and coming up with new ideas. We love to talk about problem solving and how important creativity is for problem solving. Justin, our executive director, he always says that he hopes that the person who solves like the trash crisis in the ocean is a YAT student, because he hopes that they're taking that kind of theatrical training into whatever it is that they do someday. You know, and I think that working with young people is, you know, it's a high calling. It really is. I mean, it's as cheesy as it is to say, they are our future generation. You know, and if we're looking at wanting significant social change in our country, in our world, we're looking at a lot of problems today. They're going to be the ones that solve it. You know, after I'm long gone, they're going to be the ones that find the cure for cancer, that solve the gun violence problem, that solve all of that. And so I think investing in young people is the best use of time.
You guys, do you have an upcoming production, Her Story?
Yes.
What is that about?
So that's an example of one of our devised pieces. It is part of our Court series. So the Court is our social issues group. We have a 4th through 8th grade court cast, and then we also have a high school court cast that works. Our high school court cast just did a show last night that was about gun violence in schools. Mm-hmm. This show, Her Story, is our 4th through 8th grade group. And the challenge that they took on in devising this piece was talking about the importance of education. You know, we work with a lot of kids every day, and we hear a lot of things about how boring school is, and or how anxiety-inducing school is, or stress-inducing school is. We really believe at YAT that becoming a lifelong learner is the key to success, no matter what you want to do. And so we approach the material that way, thinking like, okay, here's the problem. A lot of kids think that school's super stressful. They think it's boring. How can we talk about the importance of like taking your education into your hands, taking it, you know, even when you're in 4th grade, not just relying on the teacher to make it interesting for you, but you taking it into your own hands and getting excited about material and throwing yourself into your education long term. And so that's where the idea was born. So it's a story about a middle school girl who is stressed out by school. She doesn't like school. She thinks it's boring. And she stays up all night watching YouTube, as you do sometimes. And she then falls asleep in school the next day. And in her dream, she meets 4 historical women: Anne Frank, Harriet Tubman, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Joan of Arc. And through meeting these women in history, who showed great courage and, you know, who changed kind of the face of culture, she starts to understand the importance of like, oh, learning about them puts me on a path to success, you know, for my life. And so then when she wakes up with a whole new attitude.
Mm-hmm. So how do these productions usually work? Do the children that you work with like have a lot of creative control?
They do. Yeah. They work with one of our directors who is an adult, a professional artist who comes in and works with them to help shape the show. But they certainly have a lot of control. Like in this particular show, we kind of pitch the idea to them about like, well, what if we do a story about, you know, that involves historical figures somehow? And the students picked which ones they wanted to do after much debate about, you know, between lots of different historical figures, not just female ones. And then eventually they narrowed their focus that they wanted to focus on female historical figures, you know, that throughout time that showed a lot of courage and were inspirational people that affect us still today.
Mm-hmm. So you were kind of instrumental in developing the Court, your social issues program.
Yes.
Can you kind of explain what that is further and why it's important?
Sure. So we're really influenced at YAT by the idea of using theater for social change. I was a Butler University theater graduate, and one of my kind of big things that I was into was the theories of Augusto Boal, who is a Brazilian theater practitioner who became a politician, because that's how seriously he took like using theater to change the culture around him. And I thought that was amazing and really cool. Like, here's a guy who took art and really channeled it into affecting his community. So the Court was born out of, we had been asked a lot to come into schools and do plays about social issues, things that kids are facing, bullying, teenage violence, drinking, the use of technology in life and how that affects bullying and things like that. And so we that's actually where we started to do devised work with students. We found that, you know, with how technology changes all the time, that plays that we were purchasing that had been published even 5 years ago seemed very outdated all of a sudden. You know, drugs change fast. Technology changes fast. There's a lot of the kids are kids' lives are moving at a pretty fast speed in terms of how much is changing. So we started to do devised work, and we were like, what if we allow the students to help us create a very current piece? And that has been awesome. Our most popular show that we do in the court is our bullying show. We have a one that's geared specifically for high school students. We have one that's geared more for elementary students, and then one that's geared for middle school students. That's our most popular one, but we've done ones about violence specifically to Indianapolis. We've done one about the opioid abuse epidemic that's happening, again, specifically to Indianapolis, although certainly nationwide. We did one about health and technology and how those intersect. So we've done kind of a lot, a whole gamut of different social issues, and we're looking forward to do more. It's definitely one of my favorite programs at Young Actors Theater.
And you've actually done a lot of work in the theater field. What did you do before YAT?
Sure. So I used to be the executive artistic director of No Exit Performance, which is an awesome theater company that's still in existence. They specialize in doing kind of contemporary performance work. They do a lot of site-specific work, so you'll find them in weird spaces all the time doing lots of really interesting creative plays. And I love working with them still. I know they have a show coming up in May called Nickel and Dimed. And then I've worked with a lot of different companies, too, as an actress and then also as a director. And, you know, I love having Young Actors Theater as my home base.
Mm-hmm. Her story, it features some really powerful female figures. Mm-hmm. Do you have any favorite films that celebrate powerful females?
Ooh, I'm sure I do. yes, I love... I loved the book. I loved The Help, which I know is fictional, but mm-hmm. it is, I think, an important story as well. Hidden Figures, mm-hmm. I thought was just an awesome movie and an awesome story about women that I'm ashamed to say I didn't know anything about mm-hmm. in history. Pretty much anything Meryl Streep does becomes a movie about important female figures to me because she's... You know, oh, she's just that good. Mm-hmm. And I love, like, you know, the old Anne Frank. I love that. I love the old Miracle Worker. Mm-hmm. I mean, that movie and that play, they're just such an amazing story about not giving up on somebody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot out there. And I wish there was more, you know, and I think hopefully the tides are changing on that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think my favorite is probably Fried Green Tomatoes.
Oh, I love that movie. Yeah, that's a great one.
But then also the reworking of Mad Max with Charlize Theron.
Oh my gosh, I loved that movie.
It's wonderful.
And I loved that was, I mean, it's called Mad Max, and I love Tom Hardy. Mm-hmm. I love him. But it really is Furiosa's, mm-hmm. like, I mean, you really
Come
follow Furiosa mostly. And, you know, she had the bulk of the dialogue, and she had, she was the hero mm-hmm. in it. Mad Max is an emotional wreck. I mean, you know, so that was a great one. And it was exciting to see a woman lead. One that's on my list, speaking of Charlize, that I am going to watch soon. I haven't watched yet, was Atomic Blonde. Kind of same thing
it's great.
Is it? Yep. Like, it was like, oh, how fun. Like an action movie that's headlined by like an Oscar winning actress. Mm-hmm. Like that's awesome. Yeah. You know, and I know she did most of her own stunts and that's pretty cool.
Definitely a good one. I would recommend that.
All right. I'm putting it on my list.
So when does Her Story open and how can people see it?
So we have some school performances starting tomorrow. And that's Thursday and Friday for school groups because we do perform for school groups as well. So if you are an educator out there, know that the court is we do performances for hundreds of school kids throughout the year. And then our public performance is this Saturday, April 14th at 3 p.m. at the Central Library in their auditorium. And it's totally free to the public. So it's great for the whole family. It's appropriate for the whole family. And again, that's at 3 p.m. this Saturday, April 14th at the Central Library.
Film sociology correspondent McKenna Mays with Georgiana Wade of the Young Actors Theater Company. Young Actors Theaters. Or YAT, if you must do. Sam Watermeyer's in studio with me of the Midwest Film Journal and fellow IFJA member. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
Doing okay. This, you know, this sort of counts as work. okay, so opening in theater, just to let you know, there's a couple of things that have been seen and have not been seen, but I guess the big title opening this week, and I guess some are declaring this the start of the summer blockbuster season in mid-April, even though Solo and the Avengers movie hadn't come out yet. But it's Rampage with Dwayne Johnson. We've dropped the rock here at Film Sociology. And basically what it looks like is Gorillas in the Mist meets Transformers. And so
in a word, awesome.
You can see a fellow IFJA member, Chris Lloyd of the Film Yap. He has a review of this on Indie Style's webpage. You can go check that out. So now you have not seen it yet, but you have this underground film festival with some of the other critics. Why don't you shine a light on what you're going to be up to with this festival?
So this weekend I am joining fellow IFJA members Evan Dossey, Nick Rogers, and Joe Shearer for what we call the F Yeah Film Festival.
Thank you for cleaning that up.
You're welcome. In which we pick a theme. Usually it revolves around pulpy genre movies. Our first festival was late 80s, early 90s action movies. And usually the festival leads up to some special screening. Like the first one led up to a midnight screening of Roadhouse. You know, the festivals are usually pretty macho. And when I say festival, this isn't any kind of formal event.
This binge watching with you guys.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally just us on a couch, trying to be manly as possible and cheering during very pulpy genre movies.
Is there a lot of bongo playing and hugging like at a Promise Keepers meeting?
Not quite, but... Okay. This weekend's festival is revolving around monster movies leading up to Rampage.
So can you tell us some of the... Okay, first off, is Paddington 2 in this festival lineup?
I wouldn't be surprised if Evan picked that out. He has quite an obsession with Paddington.
And by the way, I hope to have Evan on the show, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, to celebrate the video release of Paddington 2. But we'll get to that in a little bit. And what else is on the docket for this weekend?
Yeah, we're watching monster movies, and it's all leading up to a screening of, or we're going out to see Rampage. I think some movies starring The Rock may be involved. I actually suggested watching Noah because it has rock monsters.
Oh, good Lord. And the B-52s while you're at it. Jeez. Okay. Well, that's good luck on that. Also opening in theaters, we have Beirut, John Hamm's latest attempt to make the transition from TV to film with Rosamund Pike. That's not a slight. It's true. It's just he's keeping at it. Truth or Dare, which my daughter is seeing with friends this weekend. Can't wait to hear that. We have to mention this because, well, Richard Probst is not here. Finding Your Feet is opening with Imelda Staunton and Timothy Spall. But there is a couple films I was able to see that weren't Rampage. One was, and we're still kind of in the trickling of the post-Oscar or Oscar contender effect with the awards being over. This was the Israeli submission for the Academy Awards. I don't believe it got nominated, but it's an Israeli film called Foxtrot. Not based on the comic book or the comic that was used to be in the papers. But it's the story of a gentleman who finds out that his son was killed in combat. And without giving away a whole lot, I can give you what I'm going to tell you is basically the first 30 minutes of the film. But we have the parents finding out. Then there is the agonizing routine of what you have to do once you've heard this. Now, the military comes to his house. They discuss this with him. He has to inform family. He has to inform his mother, who's in a nursing home, and we're not sure if she's quite getting all of the information right away. The father wanting to see his son's body, but there really is no body because of what happened. Mm-hmm. You know, are they going to put bricks or rocks in the casket? Things like that. So it's a situation nobody wants to endure. And then a half hour into the film, we find out that there was a different soldier with the same name who was killed in combat. Mm-hmm. And then it takes a different turn of what the boy was going, what the young man is going through while on service, meshed in with the mother and the father and a few other relatives. And it's a kick to the chest. So those are not just for the winter months anymore. So it's very powerful. And the last moment doesn't have me gasping as big as 45 years, but pretty darn close. So if you're into that, check that out. Also opening in theaters, and I'm not sure exactly where this is playing in Indy, but I got a copy of this, and it's intriguing. It's an animated film called Sergeant Stubby, an American Hero. And this is the story of, and it's based on the story of the most highly decorated dog in the U.S. Army. And this is about a dog who becomes the mascot of an army platoon in World War I. First off, and I guess it also features the voices of Helena Bonham Carter, who does a lot of, she plays the sister of the main soldier who adopts the dog. And yes, she has an American accent. The soldier is played by a voice by Logan Lerman, for you fans of Perks of Being a Wallflower, among other things. And Gerard Depardieu is in this because they need a gregarious French soldier who in his day job is a chef. Go figure. Okay. First off, Stubby is cute. Stubby, at the very, very least, if you have little kids and you want to look at a cute dog, there is that. And the dog can salute. That's always amusing. although it's funny, early on, Stubby becomes linked with the Army because he's being chased around town, chased off by business owners who call him a mangy dog. He's not really mangy looking. Yeah. But he sees them marching down the streets in small town USA. And the soldier with the Perks of Being a Wallflower Boy voice tosses the dog a cookie, and the cookie, he eats it, and he winds up following the thing. So anyway, the dog goes into combat and helps out in his own way possible. Anything as simple as delivering messages and picking up batons, things like this. And then we get into the World War I combat information. As I was watching this, I kept thinking, who is this exactly for? Because when I guess I hadn't really thought about this, and I my daughter didn't quite remember either. When did I teach my daughter World War I? And I kept thinking of do you remember the animated film Valiant?
Sounds familiar.
It's a bird voiced by Ewan McGregor, and it's a pigeon that helps out the British Army in World War II. I believe it was a Fox film, but that's the only thing I could think of when watching this, although I think it was more about the cute animals acting silly with a little World War II on the side. And as I was watching this, and by the way, my daughter came in and she kind of summed it up best. It's it has the look of when my daughter's grandmother would buy her a DVD of Mulan, but it wasn't Disney's Mulan. You know that where it's a familiar story, but it's not the studio story. It's kind of a second or third rate knockoff of the same story, just done inexpensive. Like, all right, inexpensive, cheaper, fine. But I have to credit the AV Club who summed it up best. Of course, they had the headline. Wanting to show your 6-year-old a movie about World War I meets Sergeant Stubby, but they put it as, and I have to give him credit once again. It seems narrow casted to as a slim demographic. Kids who are mature enough to watch a movie with hails of gunfire and clouds of poison gas, but not old enough for War Horse, or to step away from the kingdom of animal heroes, Wonder Woman, and that kind of sums it up best. Because there is a moment where a helmet is picked up with a bullet hole in the helmet. No blood, but a bullet hole. And so take that for what it's. I think they're gearing this toward, obviously, family-friendly, maybe your faith-based film family-going types, you know.
Hmm.
You know, lowercase t, you know, them, you know. You know, it's amusing and it's cute for him to watch. It's just, I think it's a very limited audience, and it's just an odd pairing, but I guess it had to be done. Were you going to watch this?
I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
It's the World War I dog movie
I never thought you'd ask for.
Exactly.
Okay. So that's about it. Those are basically the films that you can go check out that are new this weekend. So let's move on over to IU Cinema. Again, these all depend on when you're listening to this show. If you are listening Saturday afternoon, good for you. You could probably haul tail down and see the 3 o'clock screening of 24 Frames at IU Cinema. At 7 o'clock, you have the 2016 film Junction 48. On Sunday the 15th, because of Mira Nair speaking at IU Cinema, her 2016 film Queen of Katwe. I think I'm saying that right?
Yep.
Okay, good. And then 24 Frames at 6:30 p.m. Wednesday, April 18th, Sailing Home at 7 p.m. Thursday the 19th, Land Wind at 7 p.m. These are Italian films. They're translated for me. Thank you. Friday the 20th, First Light at 7 p.m. And Saturday the 21st at 7 p.m., Equilibrium, not the one with Christian Bale. And Sunday, April 22nd at 3 p.m. is a part of the Wide Wide West series from 1962, the first feature film from director Sam Peckinpah, Ride the High Country, with Joel McRae and Randolph Scott. You can go to the Film Yap and see Christopher Lloyd's write-up of Ride the High Country, which was done earlier this year. And then at 6:30 p.m., as a part of the Robert Altman series from 2001, Gosford Park. If you've watched Downton Abbey and you haven't seen Gosford Park, you need to do something about that. Also, at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin at 7:30 p.m. tonight, Napoleon Dynamite. Where are you with Napoleon Dynamite? Very polarizing film. I think people either get it or they don't.
I felt like I got it. I loved it the first time I saw it. I don't know how it holds up now, but I loved it when I saw it around. I was in junior high.
Oh, you're perfect.
Yeah,
perfect audience for that. That was 2004, and I always remember. My wife and I were doing a theater camp. We were co-directing a theater camp at Mud Creek Players, and one of my counselors was also at the Monday night advance screening for Napoleon Dynamite. And we wound up, for the rest of the summer, whenever we talked to each other, and if one of us asked the other a question, we would end our answers with, "What do you think?" So thanks for that. Anyway, that is happening 7:30 p.m. on Saturday. Next Friday at 7:30 p.m. as a part of the Real Women Vintage Wine Series, the first Bridget Jones's Diary. On Saturday, April 21st at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m., they have the two different sets of cartoons. It's called Cartoons for Cans. So if you bring admission, is just one can good at the door for an hour of classic Warner Brothers cartoons. And the cans are collected and donated for the Interchurch Food Pantry. And then at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday the 21st, the first National Lampoon's Vacation.
Nice.
So there is that. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In. Yes, I think we're now – well, the drive-ins have been open for a month, which I've been impressed with, especially the diehards that go in March. But here we go. On Screen 1, Rampage – and Ready Player One, which I believe are two Warner Brothers films, and they're action films. So there's a connection. Screen 2, A Quiet Place, and Unsane. Hmm. Anytime you can get a Soderbergh film in a drive-in, I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Screen 3, Truth or Dare, and The Strangers Pray at Night. Yeah, well, there's that. Scary stuff. Screen 4, Blockers, and Tyler Perry's Acrimony.
Hmm.
Two R-rated movies. That's all I got. I don't know what the connection is, so because they could. Okay, and then over at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville, you have Ready Player One, followed by Rampage. Okay, moving into the video section. By the way, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. Hanging out with Sam Watermeyer. Got a few Oscar contenders and a couple other films of note. Probably the biggest title to come out, and it's Chris Lloyd has brought this up on more than one occasion. It is probably one of the quieter success stories of the end of the year. The Greatest Showman. Hmm. With Hugh Jackman, and it's P.T. Barnum, and it's a musical based on his life story. It's in the, I guess, Beautiful Mind school of let's just leave some stuff out and focus on him trying to get a circus going. I guess so. We'll just leave it at that. With lots of flashy musical numbers, and. What I remember seeing this film in December, and I guess the fact that it was still, it's up until last week, it was still in theaters. It just kept going, kept making money. You know, Jackman's fine, and some of the musical numbers are all right. It makes Moulin Rouge look like Rodgers and Hammerstein, I guess. if Moulin Rouge was a splashy musical, and that's a polarizing musical for a lot of people, I think The Greatest Showman is a series of music videos kind of put together with a story. So it's a step above Jukebox Musical, but it's even more, I guess, more of a visual overload for my taste. But the kids like it. So that is on video now. You can check that out. If you didn't want to sit through it in the theaters, you can now rent it. The high drama, the Academy Award nominated drama, Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread, which has buttering toast just as loud as anything in Rampage and The Greatest Showman. Your thoughts on Phantom Thread?
Well, it has one of my all-time favorite lines of dialogue, which is, "I cannot start my day with a confrontation."
Yes.
Which I want to say so badly on so many days.
You haven't done it yet?
No, not yet. I'm saving it for a special occasion.
Very good. This film spawned so many more memes than I had ever anticipated. So kudos to whoever is creating these. It's a very good Paul Anderson film. It's not great, but the tension between a woman and a fashion designer who just likes everything in order. Mm. As I mentioned, there's a great scene where buttering toast too loud and it wrecks your day. I'm sure we all have some form of behavioral quirks, patterns like that. Maybe not to this degree, and maybe not like Daniel Day-Lewis. But anyway, but it's really well acted. And also should be noted, Leslie Manville, who plays his sister. She also, I think, has the second best one. I know I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, don't fight me, I'll destroy you.
Right.
You know, that kind of sibling. So anyway, that is out there. We also have Molly's Game, which for me, Molly's Game and I, Tanya, were competing for the most Goodfellas feeling film of last year. This is the directorial debut of Aaron Sorkin, who did the screenplay. Really good performance from Jessica Chastain as a woman who organizes an underground poker game for the very, 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 very wealthy and the trouble she gets in and out of. Idris Elba is in this film as well. Like a lot of first-time directors, it could use a little trimming, but I was still engaged for the most part. Sam?
I wasn't crazy about it, mostly because it felt like something I had seen a million times before.
When I say Goodfellas, a lot of wall-to-wall music and a lot of voiceover and a little mansplaining from Kevin Costner.
Just that sort of, you know, smooth-talking narration and you know, I got kind of lost in the poker stuff. I don't know. I was more engaged by the relationship between Jessica Chastain and Kevin Costner's character. But then again, that was also kind of standard, you know, daddy issues drama.
I
am a fan of Aaron Sorkin, but I wasn't crazy about that one.
Okay. Also on DVD and Blu-ray this week, the Academy Award nominated All the Money in the World from Ridley Scott, which will forever be known as the film Christopher Plummer played Kevin Spacey or something like that. Yes, this is the film based on a true story of the kidnapping of Jay Getty's grandson, and the fact that the grandfather played in this film was by Kevin Spacey. He was canned, and then they rushed in with about a little over a month before the film's release. They shot in 9 days all of Spacey's scenes again, this time with Christopher Plummer, who scored an Oscar nomination out of this. So kudos to Plummer for that. It also helps that Plummer's grandson is in the film playing the kidnapped son, kidnapped kid in this film. Michelle Williams is in it as the mother. Mark Wahlberg trying to go against type as the hostage negotiator, but he's wearing spectacles, so he's smart and crafty with no guns shot. Well, in this case. If anything, it is fascinating to watch with Plummer. The story behind this was he was not going to pay a $17 million ransom, even though this man was worth close to trillions. I mean, there was billions with a capital B, and his theory is if I do this, then all of my grandchildren are going to get kidnapped, and I'm going to have to pay the ransom. So there is a certain but seeing Plummer at 89. Still kind of standing tall, and you know, when you have when you're playing the billionaire of a family, head of the family, and the fact that he's has moments where he's washing his own clothes because it's cheaper than sending him down to get done by room service, little things like that. The film's about 20 minutes too long. I'm always interested and always happy to see Ridley Scott doing something that's not in the sci-fi fantasy realm, because the last few have been a little, but other than that, it is your kind of standard hostage situation. We go back and forth between the kid and his captors, which they try to build a little camaraderie, not really camaraderie, but chemistry. And then, of course, with the mom, played by Michelle Williams, who's kvetching, and Mark Wahlberg, who's negotiating. So, anyway, that is out there.
The sort of strange, old-timey accent she was trying to do bothered me.
Really? I think her reshoot pay probably was really the most bothersome thing.
Oh,
but
well, that too.
I'm being snarky on that. And then the other title of note, and this came out in January, and I had some hopes for it, and then I watched it. It's Proud Mary, the film with Taraji P. Henson as an assassin. And if you look at the trailers for this, it has a 70s blaxploitation feel. Taraji P. Henson, you know, kind of channeling her inner Pam Grier. And I was hoping that it was going to be something like that. It isn't. Yes, there's some flashy colors and 70s font for the title of the film. And yes, the song is used. And there's other songs from the era and remixes of songs from the era. But it's shot from the director of London Has Fallen. And he's no Quentin. He doesn't try to be either. But it just becomes just another action film, which really bummed me out. And I was hoping, if you just tried to do a 70s knot, and I know if they did, and I guess everybody would compare it to Jackie Brown, but it would have been at least something. And the other thing, the other film that this film owes a nod to is the John Cassavetes film Gloria with Jenna Rollins. So in this, Henson's character takes out a target and doesn't realize that there was a young boy, the target's son, in another room with his headphones on playing games, and just leaves him. And then we cut to an hour later. He's now working the streets. He's working as a lackey for the Russian mob. And she kills the mobster who's his boss and takes the boy under her wing, so almost to adopt. And then there's some conflicts not only between the Russian mob and the African-American mob. By the way, African-American mob in Boston. Interesting. And that family is fronted by Danny Glover. Nice to see him playing a heavy. Margaret Avery has a small role in this as well. And anyway, I would have liked a little flash in style, even if you wanted to do, like Jackie Brown, do a mixture of an old school look in a modern day setting. Something, anything. I mean, Henson looks great. She can fire a gun. And she's an executive producer on this, so she was able to, you know, kick butt and take names. But the action scenes we've seen every other week. And so that I was really bummed out on that. I was hoping for maybe a little more style, or at least a different type of style than what we have on video. But anyway, those are the films happening at the video store. Okay, I want to get to dead people we like because we never have time for dead people we don't like. And if you're my age or older, you know the voice work. Or maybe if you're a cartoon fanatic, you know actor Chuck McCann, who passed away on April 8th at the age of 83. Going back, his credits go back to live television back in the 50s and appearing on shows like the Steve Allen Plymouth Show. And then just little bitty things, like did a slew of TV, everything from Bonanza to films like Play It As It Lays. Herbie Rides Again. Of course, he was on Columbo. He appeared in, yes, Linda Lovelace for President. It's a job. There was a film, a TV series, a short-lived series from the 70s called Far Out Space Nuts. It's him and Bob Denver. Played a studio guard in Silent Movie. Played a theater manager in Foul Play. I do remember there was a TV movie of Mae West with Ann Gillian. He played W.C. Fields. And then did a lot of cartoon voiceover work in everything from Pac-Man, Iron Man, DuckTales, Tailspin. Are these any these titles doing anything for you, sir? That's okay if they're not. These are the 80s and 90s. Powerpuff Girls, he's done a few voices there. Was a villager in Robin Hood Men in Tights. Was a voice in the 90s TV series of the Fantastic Four. Lots of things. So anyway, and if you look up a picture of him, you've seen it. He's that guy. So anyway, and we like working actors. Tim O'Connor, best known as the Elliot Carson in the TV series version of Peyton Place, also appeared in The Naked Gun 2½, Buck Rogers in the 25th Century back in 1979. Was a lieutenant and across 110th Street in the hilariously titled that's the film with Dirk Benedict and Strother Martin, where snakes are, where mad scientists is morphing humans into snakes. That's from 1973. It was also a Svengoolie film. It's really odd. This is part of the band Scientists along with Nature Gone Wrong films of the early 70s. And of course, all the television incarnations of Peyton Place. Now, finally, we have a cinematographer, camera department head, Ralph Woolsey, who lived to be 104. So there's, first off, way to go getting your money. His last credit was 1980 and did a lot of TV going back to, and some films in the documentaries back in the 1940s. 50s films like Birthright, Mr. Texas, Oil Town USA, Burden of Proof, The Persuader. You're going to know his work, even though you don't know his name. But films, TV shows like Bourbon Street Beat, Colt 45, Maverick, Lawman, Bronco, Surfside 6, 77 Sunset Strip, Hawaiian Eye, It Takes a Thief, the series of that, the series version of Mr. Roberts. But here you go, ladies and gentlemen. He is the one who created, he did 10 episodes of this series. He's the one who created the extreme close-ups and the weird angled sequences in Batman.
Oh, wow.
That guy, there you go. So so you can thank this gentleman right here. So in,
thank you, sir.
Yes, exactly. Because, man, that was, I think for a lot of kids, that might have been the first, well, of a certain era, when they were watching this, that might have been the first time of you see these kind of weird angles. Everything is normally straightforward shooting. So So thanks for that. He also did some films in the 70s, including a director of photography for films like The Strawberry Statement, Honky, The Culpeper Cattle Club, The Mac, thank you. The film version of The Iceman Cometh with Lee Marvin, Black Eye, the Fred Williamson detective movie, 99 and 44/100% Dead, Mother Jugs and Speed, Lifeguard, The Pack, The Promise, the TV movie of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, Robert Duvall's The Great Santini, The Last Married Couple in America, and his last film, Oh God, Book 2. So thank you, Ralph, and thank you for those weird-looking Batman episodes. We really needed those. All right, got about a quarter left of the show. Now, Sam, you had written something a couple of weeks back to to celebrate the release of Ready Player One. By the way, where were you on Ready Player One?
I actually didn't see it.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, but you did this anyway. Okay, yeah. Cool. We'll see it happen someday. Ladies and gentlemen, film critics actually see films. Don't worry about it. But so first off, I guess, what is happening over at the Midwest Film Journal?
So I've started a column called Scene by Scene, in which I take a look at five signature scenes from a major filmmaker's career. And usually it coincides with the release of their latest film.
Sure.
So, you know, for my first entry to coincide with Phantom Thread, I took a look at scenes from Paul Thomas Anderson's career. So for Spielberg, I actually decided to look at some less discussed moments. I think, you know, obviously when people think of Spielberg, they think of, you know,
the bike in the air.
Right. Or Indiana Jones outrunning a rolling boulder and
right.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. He creates these instantly iconic images. But I actually tried to steer away from those, and I focused more on latter-day Spielberg scenes.
Well, can you tell us what you, and which ones did you discuss?
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't know if you want to, you know, build tension and go through the top five.
Sure.
But for number five, I chose a scene from The Post. And it's a scene in which Katharine Graham, who was the publisher of The Washington Post, and kind of one of the first female publishers of a major American newspaper, it's after a scene in which the Washington Post dodges a federal injunction around the time that the paper was trying to publish the Pentagon Papers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really powerful, iconic image of Graham walking down the steps of the Supreme Court, and she's kind of walking through a sea of women who are empowered by what she's doing. And it's really a perfect image for the times we're living in now, especially with, you know, the women's movement currently sweeping the nation.
Oh, but this film was set in the 70s.
I think, you know, it's an incredibly timely image and very relevant. And I think people focus so much on Spielberg's sort of timeless scenes that they forget how he can really also tap into the zeitgeist and reflect what's going on today as well.
Agreed. Very good.
And then number four, speaking of kind of reflecting the times, I picked a scene from War of the Worlds in which after the first kind of alien attack, Tom Cruise rises from the rubble and returns home, and he, you know, shakes off the debris. And, you know, that film came out in 2004, and you can't help but, you know, see the ashes of 9/11 in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Or think about Ground Zero. So that's another example of Spielberg's ability to kind of tap into the mood of the times.
Very good.
And then number three, I picked a scene from Minority Report in which these robotic spiders are pursuing Tom Cruise.
And it's funny because I thought of, when I was watching it, I kept thinking of the kitchen scenes in Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah.
But faster. And kind of a more menacing aspect. It was, I think, it was more like the, it was more the robotic car in the Deadpool than it was the slow moving dinosaurs and stalking in kitchens in Jurassic Park.
Well, that's funny you mentioned Jurassic Park because I actually said in the column that in this scene the spiders kind of feel as iconic as, like the truck in Duel or the shark in Jaws.
Nice.
Or, you know, the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, obviously. And I remember seeing Minority Report in the theater, and during that scene I felt like I was kind of witnessing the birth of a new classic. I don't know if it you know, is really heralded as one of Steven Spielberg's best films, but I think it should be.
I think it's one of his maybe underappreciated popcorn films, but I mean, at the time, I remember reviewing it on Fox, but one could also look back and look at the technology that was being done 15 years ago, 16 years ago, and what we have now. So somebody should do a retrospect on that. I'm not looking at Sammy. He's got enough to do. So anyway, continue, please.
And then number two is the last scene in Munich. And, you know, the leader of this group of Mossad assassins, Eric Bana, is trying to figure out whether they really accomplished anything in their mission to assassinate the terrorists responsible for killing the Israeli athletes in the Munich Olympics. And he's kind of wondering, you know, whether they really did sort of defeat the monsters, so to speak, or whether they just created more.
I saw that in Palm Springs. I'm sorry, here comes a name dropping moment. That same day, I went out and smoked cigars with Fred the Hammer Williamson, film sociology guest and sort of buddy, sort of friend. Anyway, but we were catching up on what we did that day, and I told him I saw Munich, and he said, "Well, what'd you think?" And I said, "I really liked it, and you know, it kind of taps into a dark area, and it shows you that maybe revenge is not all it's cracked up to be." And Fred Williamson, I'm going to reword what he said, but basically he drew out the word. He just said, "Stuff." Because if you know Fred's films, revenge is sweet. And always has been, always will be. So he didn't say stuff. You get the idea. But yeah, I always think, when I think of Munich, I think of Fred Williamson, not Knocked Up. So there. Okay, what is your number one?
My number one is actually a scene from Catch Me If You Can. It's a moment between Leonardo DiCaprio and Christopher Walken. Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Frank Abagnale, is in the middle of impersonating an airline pilot at the time. And, you know, he's treating his father, who he's always looked up to kind of a fancy lunch and showing off the fact that he's a pilot and trying to kind of win him over. And then Christopher Walken tells a story about how he met Frank's mother. And it's a story he's told a million times. It's kind of one of his go-to stories, and he's used to charming people with it, but he ends up breaking down. And actually what's cool about the scene is that that was totally Christopher Walken's choice. It wasn't in the script that he breaks down. He just, you know, decided to do that in the moment. And there's a behind the scenes clip of Spielberg reacting to that scene and applauding Christopher Walken for making that choice that he wasn't expecting him to make. So it's kind of a magical acting moment. But I picked this scene because, you know, I think we're used to Spielberg kind of sweeping us away with otherworldly spectacles, and we forget that he can sweep us away with very simple human moments like this, too.
And there's always been a special bond between child and parent in his films, if you go through those patterns, so... Very good. Very cool.
Thank you.
So Sam asked me to come up with five. Not nearly as esoteric as those, and I mean that as a compliment. I wouldn't have picked those because I needed to revisit them. But the five I picked, and they're all from the early part of his career, because I thought of the most recent is The Little Girl with the Balloon in Schindler's List, and just that mixture of. You're reminded that you're watching a film, even, you know, at times, especially with that film that has a documentary feel to it. And then we have this very long sequence with a little girl with a red balloon and it with the payoff with what happens to her. Number four, the truck chase in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah, everybody talks about the ball, But there's some real stunt work going on there, and it's fun, and you get to see the sweat and the swagger of Indiana Jones and Harrison Ford to a certain degree. Number three, the boy opening the door in Close Encounters, because Spielberg has made these adventures, whether they're in the water or in space or on Earth, and the overwhelming aspect of what he's able to do. That means more to me than all of his people looking up in awe reaction shots that he's known for. Number two is Jaws, the beginning of Jaws, because I was 5 years old when I saw Jaws in the theater, and it scared the living crap out of me. And I couldn't, looking back as I got older, it also didn't help that I was on Long Beach Island, New Jersey.
Oh, wow.
My grandfather walked out. I thought he was the old man in the sea. And then the next day, my father took me to the beach and lifted me over his head and started marching toward the water and just said two notes. Just said, dun, and I screamed. And looking back, I thought, oh, a piece of celluloid did that. Huh. Mm. That may have started the obsession with films. And then the first thing I picked, the earliest one, the 1970, and I'm kind of cheating, the 1971 episode of Columbo, Murder by the Book. And I'll tell you why. Because I know everybody brings up Duel. And Duel is great, and also his episode of Night Gallery. But in 1971, there's a shot. It's the opening shot of the show. You should watch Columbo anyway. It's brilliant. But it's a shot of a car on a highway, or on a main city street. And then it backs up, backs up, backs up, and you realize you're looking through a window. You keep backing up, and you can hear the guy typing, and it's Martin Milner at a typewriter typing. Going from the focal point of a car in the street, backing all the way up, then you realize it's shooting through a mirror, and then the guy at the typewriter, all in a single tracking shot. This was not done in the early 70s, and of course Spielberg was one of these young fancy film school kids that were going to infiltrate television and eventually Hollywood. So anyway, he brought, if you look at that and Night Gallery, and of course Duel, and Duel went over so well they released it in theaters. So those are mine. And it's funny that you mentioned this list when you first brought it up to me, because of course the AV Club had a list, and we got about 3 minutes, the 25 best set pieces of Spielberg's career. Here we go. Number one, the police mobilizing in the Sugarland Express. Number two, the opening scene in Jaws, or as they call it, Chrissy gets bitten and bites it. Number three, the abduction, Close Encounters. Number four, the Ferris wheel scene in 1941, which was done in miniatures. Number five, Raiding the Temple, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Number six, Truck Chase, later Raiders of the Lost Ark. Number seven, Melting Nazis. I think we all know that. Number eight, Bike Takes Flight. Number nine, The Bridge in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Yeah. Number 10, The Assault on Shanghai in Empire of the Sun. Number 11, The Three Trials, Last Crusade. Number 12, The T-Rex Attack. Number 13, Raptors in the Kitchen. Number 14, Liquidating the Ghetto, in Schindler's List. Number 15, Over the Cliff, Lost World, Jurassic Park. Number 16, D-Day, Private Ryan. Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Number 17, The Flesh Fair from AI. Number 18, Introducing Pre-Crime in Minority Report. Number 19, The First Attack in War of the Worlds. Number 20, Failed Escape by Water, War of the Worlds. 21, Assassination by Phone, Munich. 22, The Chase from The Adventures of Tintin. Number 23, No Man's Land in War Horse. By the way, stage version of War Horse, considerably different. Trust me on this. Number 24, The Big Vote in Lincoln. And number 25, Spy Games from Bridge of Spies. And Ready Player One is fun. We talked about this with Chris Lloyd a few weeks ago. I had not read the book, but I enjoyed it capturing the spirit of the 80s underdog films. And it reminded me of The Last Starfighter with a bunch of really cool special effects. And Ben Mendelsohn has a great performance as an 80s authoritative D-bag. So if you like those guys, Paul Gleason or William Atherton. Mm. Yeah, you can put Ben Mendelsohn in that group. So, all right. Once again, where can people go to see your writing, Sam?
MidwestFilmJournal.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by. Soylent Green is people. Zardoz is spoken. Sam, thanks for hanging out.
Thank you.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD To The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!